Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Alaska Zoo, where Anchorage wildlife biologist Rick Sinnott is speaking on planning to keep big wildlife in Anchorage. As part of the Wildlife Wednesdays lecture series at the Alaska Zoo, Rick Sinnott was recorded on March 10th in Anchorage.
Thanks. Planning is the thing I like to do least, but it's probably one of the most important things biologists do at Fish and Game, and other agencies, of course, because it's long-term. Most everything else I do is reactive. You know, moose in a fence, moose dying on the side of the road, wolves chasing dogs. You know, you have to react to all these things. But when you get to actually look into the future and interact with other agencies or within Fish and Game and come up with a plan that's going to affect wildlife in the long term, that's really important, and we really should do more of that. Actually, the part of Fish and Game that probably does the most planning or interacting with other agencies' plans is Habitat Division, and I worked for them for quite a while back in the 90s, late 80s and 90s. And they work mostly with fish, anadromous fish, but they also get involved in lots of other coastal plans and city plans and things like that. And they're trying to keep communities keep wildlife in communities, in your communities, so that, you know, it's a quality of life thing, and people really enjoy having wildlife around, not just for viewing, but for hunting and trapping and things like that, if, you know, that's illegal in that area. But wildlife are important. I mentioned already the quality of life. I'm talking about Anchorage specifically now. That's what I'll be talking about mostly. Wildlife are important for a quality of life because people want them. And we've done a couple of surveys in the last 13 years, and I'd like to talk a little bit about them, public surveys, because they have been very instructive to many people, but me especially, because when I get questions and I'm trying to decide which direction to go, it helps to sort of get an unvarnished view of what the public thinks. Because I get phone calls all the time. People are mad about this, and people are mad about that. Every once in a while, someone's happy about something, but that's rare. They don't call me when they're happy about it. But these surveys, you know, they give you this kind of the straight shot. It's like, okay, this is what the Anchorage public really thinks in their heart of hearts about wildlife. So those, I'll talk about those in a minute, because those are very important planning tools, actually, that I use all the time. And I try to make sure that other agencies know about them so that they can use them as well. And then, of course, wildlife are important because of not just for quality of life, not just because people want them, but just because as the dominant species, I think it's easy to say humans are the dominant species on Earth because we seem to be changing a lot of Earth to sort of to fit our needs. As the dominant species, we need to preserve all the other species. I mean, that's important, and we need to preserve the natural biological diversity of species. And, you know, it's easy to imagine that happening in Chugach State Park or Denali National Park, someplace like that. It's like, well, that's a park. You should have the whole wide spectrum of wildlife there. But I believe, and many people believe, that even in cities like Anchorage, you know, 250,000-plus people, we need to preserve the natural diversity. And that doesn't mean we need to have brown bears running up and down, you know, 4th Avenue every day. We try to avoid that as much as possible. But if it happens sometimes, that's cool too, you know. But we just need to have as many of the natural things around as possible, because if it turns out that the only place that wildlife can survive in their natural diversity are parks and wildlife refuges, there ain't enough of those in the world to keep us going. We're going to end up with, I don't know what it is, 5% of the land mass is now preserved in parks and refuges and things like that. But that ain't enough for the wildlife. We need to have many more places that wildlife are not necessarily given full rein, but I mean, people, cities are people habitat, but we need to make sure that we preserve as much as possible, and that includes cities. And that includes wolves and bears and moose in cities, even though they can be potentially dangerous. And I'm not being too much of a wild-eyed idealist when I say that, because I really think these surveys have informed me that most of the Anchorage public feels the same way about those species in particular. So usually when people think of, you know, they try to think of what I do for a living, it's you know, I interact with hunters and I interact with wildlife watchers, and I try to preserve those opportunities as much as possible. And in order to do that, we count wildlife, some animals anyway, moose, mountain goats, sheep in the Anchorage area, sometimes geese, things like that, sometimes wolves, wolverines. But we count animals. Sometimes we chase animals out of schoolyards or, you know, whatever. Sometimes we rescue animals or we shoot animals because they've been particularly dangerous. For example, a bear mauling somebody, or because a moose has a broken leg. So those are the things biologists do on a day-to-day basis. And those are the fun things primarily. But a lot of those things don't really have much to do with planning, except obviously counting of animals and knowing sort of the distribution and the movement corridors of animals is very important. And so I have a very small budget. I think my budget it runs between $12,000 and $15,000 a year. That's for pencils and airplane flying and everything. But we do try to count moose every year. And we've been very fortunate in the last few years to partner with some other agencies, particularly the military reservations here in town, Fort Richardson and Elmendorf Air Force Base. They get sometimes federal money. This isn't, I guess it's Department of Defense money, but they're required by law to sort of keep track of wildlife on their bases for a variety of reasons. And they've ended up with little pots of money. To me, they look big, but to them, they're fairly small compared to, you know, the war in Iraq or something, or just running a base on a day-to-day basis. But we've ended up with little pots of money to buy some radio collars for moose, for wolves, for wolverines, and for both black and brown bears in the Anchorage area. So we've been that, and that's what I've been doing the last couple of weeks. One reason why I don't have slides tonight is because last week we were 24/7. We were sitting on about a half a mile away from wolf traps, trying to catch wolves in traps to put radio collars on them. We caught one and missed a couple, but you catch them in a leg hold trap just like a trapper would, except they're offset and they don't hurt their feet. Ideally, usually not. So you catch them, you put the radio collar on, you let them go, and then these are GPS radio collars that allow the collar to locate the wolf's location on a set basis, and I think we've got them down to 1 hour. So every hour it locates where the wolf is, stores the information on the collar, and then we can download that remotely or get the collar back eventually, and we'll know exactly where that wolf has been every hour for that period. And so that's very useful information. For example, for wolves, and I'm talking about planning here. This is exciting. It's wildlife type stuff, but it's also planning, because if we know where the wolves hang out, and we know what the movement corridors, the travel corridors of those wolves are, that's very useful for planning. We know just because of anecdotal information that once or twice a year a wolf gets hit by the way station crossing the glen, because there's a one wolf pack that's mostly on the east side of the Glen Highway that sometimes goes on to Fort Rich on the west side, and they seem to cross at the end of the fence right there near the way station. And like I say, the pack crosses, and about once or twice a year a wolf gets hit by a car and killed. I don't think there's anything we can do to fix that, but it'd be nice to know if that was really the one place in town that they wanted to cross the Glen Highway. Maybe in the future, if you know, the funding was available, or if there were other reasons to do it, that might be a good place for a wildlife underpass, because wolves will use a wildlife underpass. They don't like the Ship Creek one, apparently, because they don't use that one. But let me talk about that for a second. I told you this was going to be a free-flowing thing tonight. It's like chain of consciousness. I'm going to get back to... let me finish the thing about radio collars first. We've also done it with moose, and we're doing it now. This week we've been catching moose, and so today I spent 8 or 10 hours in crotch-deep snow on snowshoes, but I was still that deep, waiting around trying to re-catch some of our radio-collared moose so we can change the collar, because the batteries run out after a while. And today the moose didn't cooperate. The moose were running circles around me through the woods, and they never let me get close enough. You got to get within, like, I don't know, 30 yards at the most for a dart gun before you're going to have any hope of hitting them, especially in the woods. And they wouldn't let me get within 35 yards. You know, they were staying just out of reach, probably because they've been darted once or twice before. Anyway, we've done that with moose. We've got some color still on black bears. Sean Farley, Dr. Sean Farley, our bear biologist, and Jesse Coltrane, my assistant, and I spent a couple of years actually collaring brown bears in this area, again, with funding the Fort Rich and Elmendorf and BLM and others all kind of threw in a little bit of money. We did, too. And we got a great study on brown bears. I think Sean ended up with maybe 13 brown bears with radio collars on, again, these GPS radio collars. So he had really good information on bear locations and bear movements. And, of course, it wasn't every bear in town because this was a small portion of the brown bears that are in and around Anchorage. But we had very good information on those bears, where they wanted to hang out during the summer, which was primarily, you know, for most of them around anadromous fish streams, to and from these salmon spawning streams pretty much every day or every few days. And also their movement, you know, their movement paths between the streams and down, up and down the stream. So that's really good information for planning because we've used that in the last couple of years to try to make realistic choices about where to put new streams, new trails, for example. It's like, you know, we've got the Anchorage area has something like 500 miles of maintained trails, both in the city and in Chukesh State Park. And that's a lot of trails, but people always want more. We have more people, you want more trails, and trails are good. But every once in a while, someone wants to put a trail alongside of a salmon spawning stream where there's lots of bears. And in the past, we would always kind of scratch our heads and we'd say, you know, it's a salmon spawning stream and there's a lot of salmon in there. There's probably lots of brown bears on that stream, but we really didn't have any idea how often they were there. But now we know, because of this data we collected from the radio callers, that bears are there not just a few days a week or a few days of summer. Brown bears are on those streams every single day, and not just one or two brown bears. But Sean found, based on just hair samples that he collected from twigs on the south and north fork of Campbell Creek and a couple other locations in north and south Anchorage, he found that there were 20 brown bears using Bicentennial Park. Holy cow. I mean, I knew there were brown bears in Bicentennial Park, but I didn't know there were 20 brown bears. At least, that's a minimum. I mean, he didn't find hairs from every bear. He was using DNA sampling, by the way, or DNA fingerprinting techniques to identify individual bears. But so 20 brown bears in Bicentennial Park, and that was a couple summers ago. So, let's see, wolves, moose, bears. Now let me talk about that Ship Creek. What is it? Underpass, I guess. It's a wildlife crossing. It's actually a bridge. When DOT was going to redo the Glen Highway about 20 years ago, they were going to widen the lanes. They were going to, you know, improve the surfaces. And they wanted to put up a fence along the Glen, the fence that you see today, pretty much, although it's been improved by the Army, to keep moose. That was one of the highest hit areas in the Anchorage area for car collisions with moose, because it was no secret that moose cross the road there all the time. They go up and down the Ship Creek Valley and surrounding lands, and some moose make several passes back and forth across the Anchorage Bowl every year, for example. And there's no real pattern to it that we've been able to tell. A moose will go and have its calf either on the west side of Anchorage or the east side of Anchorage, for example. And then when the calf is a few weeks old, it'll pick up and move across the glen to the other side or across town to the other side and raise the calf over there. And then when rutting season comes, it's going to go trekking with the calf back up to the mountains, for example, to rut, or maybe back to Kincaid Park to rut, to meet the bulls. And, you know, they make these crossings all the time. Not every moose, but quite a few of them do. And so when DOT was talking about, you know, making this a bigger and better road with a lot more traffic. They were expecting a lot more traffic even 20 years ago, obviously. And they're going to put the fence to sort of keep moose from crossing. We said, well, wait a minute. You know, the moose are going to want to cross that road somewhere. So why don't we try to give them a place to cross? And one obvious place was Ship Creek, where there was a bridge, and they were going to make that bridge bigger and better. And so we worked with them. Mike McDonald was the biologist at the time, 20 years ago, that worked with them to make the bridge a little higher, a little wider. And then he added one interesting thing, which was basically a sidewalk for moose under the bridge. None of you have probably ever been under the Ship Creek Bridge and looked, because it's hard to stop there. You can't really stop on the glen and look out, because you'll get hit by somebody or picked up by APD. But if you're able to look under the bridge, there's a... The concern was that the creek in the wintertime, the ice gets thicker and thicker because it overflows and gets this big jumbled mass of ice under there, and moose wouldn't want to cross it. So Mike actually had the engineers design a low curb with a kind of a gravelly walkway on one side of it so that that doesn't get flooded. And the moose can then walk across basically this gravel underneath the bridge. And some moose do. And it was a partial success. It was actually the very first moose crossing underpass that was designed specially for moose. It was kind of a retrofit. It really wasn't designed for moose, but it was sort of, they tried to make it for moose. And they did the best they could with information at the time and with the constraints that the engineers had for building the road. But it's not perfect because we've noticed over the last 20 years that a lot of moose don't seem to want to use it. It's not really quite tall enough. It really has a tunnel effect. If you're looking at it from the side, kind of looking through like a moose would, it looks like walking into a tunnel. And, you know, some of the Anchorage moose will walk through tunnels. You could probably get some moose in Midtown to walk through they do. They walk through 30, 40-foot tunnels in the pedestrian underpasses around Westchester Lagoon. But most moose are way too wary to do that. And will they ever learn? I don't know. Maybe a moose doesn't live long enough to learn how to do that, except when they have to do it all the time, like in town. But we've just noticed kind of anecdotally over the years that moose will sometimes walk up to the underpass and then turn around and walk away. And the Army a couple of years ago actually put some of these trail cameras, these infrared sensing cameras, underneath the thing just to record, you know, who or what goes under there. I suspect it was primarily to catch, you know, terrorists or me or you or someone like that, but because, you know, they actually called me one time and said, we saw you under the underpass. But what they really have been recording is wildlife use. And so that's another planning tool that you can use cameras. And they've said the black bears use that fairly frequently, that underpass, but not very many moose do. So I suspect that despite all the best efforts, because of the constraints at the time, money and engineering and stuff, that's not the best underpass. So we've been working with DOT for a number of years now, I don't know, more than 10, trying to get them to, you know, obviously keep wildlife in mind when they build roads. And wildlife is way down on their list of priorities, understandably. I mean, you got, you know, car safety. A lot more people kill themselves, you know, running into each other or running off the road than they do hitting moose. A lot more people hit pedestrians than moose. But so that's their main concerns. But we like to try to keep wildlife at least in the mix. And we're always agitating and trying to convince them to put underpasses where we really think that they needed to be put. So we've worked with them on that, and we've tried to get them to build bigger and better underpasses, not the sort of the marginal ones like Ship Creek. There's actually been some research done in Scandinavia that sort of have some minimum requirements for what moose will accept in an underpass, and so we've tried to pass that on to DOT. Who else have we worked with? A lot of the stuff we work with is obviously because it's wildlife related, it involves trails. We work with Chukesh State Park on trail planning. We work with the city a lot on trail planning. And not just the obvious things, like I mentioned, the brown bears and salmon spawning streams, but also just we really had a campaign a few years ago to convince the city to put bear-resistant garbage containers in all the parks that bears regularly visit. And it was kind of a hump. We had to really get over this hump because they're expensive. And in fact, under one of the previous mayors, several mayors back, Mayor Meistrom, I believe it was, you know, his folks calculated how much it would cost to replace all these open 55-gallon drums with no tops on them, which they're using for garbage cans in parks, with bear-resistant cans. And it was like $300,000. Nobody wants to pay $300,000 to do that. But if you just do a few at a time, kind of work it into the thing, and you're avoiding creating problem bears, and you're setting a good example, which is the thing that we kept saying, the city should set a good example, because we're citing people, you know, we're fining people $100 at the time for letting bears get into the garbage, and the city is like feeding them in the park across the street. Not good. And it's really hard to cite the city. I mean, I've been tempted to go write a citation to someone in the city numerous times, all the way from the guy that picks up the garbage to the mayor, and you never quite, it's this multi-headed beast, as any agency is, you know, you don't know who to cite. If you cite the poor sucker that was supposed to empty the garbage, it's like, well, my boss told me, you know, you can work all the way up to the mayor, but then you don't want to cite the mayor, obviously, because that's kind of making a political statement more than, you know, finding the guy who actually did it. So, but we worked hard with the city, and the city under Mayor Begich really came around and understood what the problem was. And so they've been doing very good. This is more kind of a direct aspect of wildlife planning. They've been very good at slowly replacing, I don't know what it is, several dozen, I guess, a year in the parks that needed them most, like up against the hillside and up against Chugach State Park and in Bicentennial Park and in Centennial Park. So I used to say Centennial Park was the campground there, kind of, you know, where the Glen leaves town near Muldoon, was probably the worst campground in the world for having bear problems. I was probably exaggerating a little bit, but every summer it's like they'd be running black bears back and forth through the campground and getting in the tents and stuff like that. And after several years of working with those folks, they got it, and they realized, you know, why that was a problem and what they could do about it. And like I say, we've been working with DOT for years and really trying to make sure that, I mean, it's not just underpasses on roads are not just a wildlife conservation issue. In some places they are, like in Florida, you know, they have an endangered species of panther, cougars, mountain lions, you know, whatever you want to call them. And they have various reptiles and things that are endangered. And a lot of those things get killed on their highways. So those guys have gone big into wildlife underpasses, and for a good reason, for wildlife diversity. In Anchorage, it's not so much the fact that we would kill off all the moose if cars were hitting, you know, as many moose as they wanted or didn't want to hit every year. It's more a matter of, do we really want people running into moose? I mean, that's not a very safe thing. So we argue the public safety aspect of it, not so much the wildlife conservation aspect when we're talking about moose and underpasses. And the one that Doug mentioned, the Elmore Road one, the new one that they put in a couple of years ago, we worked very closely with DOT on that one. And I guess, unfortunately for me, that's probably the best moose underpass in the city, but it wasn't for moose. It was actually because it was crossing some wetlands. The Corps of Engineers and EPA and those folks that do the wetland protection said, you can't put that road on the ground there. That's, you know, those are protected wetlands. You need to put a bridge over it. So they were going to put a bridge over it. So my only task was to make sure they made the bridge tall enough. I mean, it was definitely going to be wide enough. It was going to be hundreds of feet across, but it could have been hundreds of feet across and been this high, you know, 2 feet high, and moose wouldn't have gone under it. So, and every foot, they told me, every foot they raised that thing was going to cost $100,000. So they really wanted me to shave. I kept saying, you got to get it, you know, it's got to be at least 13 feet high, blah, 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 blah. And based on this research in Scandinavia, and they said, well, it's going to be like 20 feet high in the center. It's only going to be, you know, 10 feet high on the sides because it's kind of arched. So it kind of makes a big arch. And I'm like, well, that's good, because if it's, you know, 20 feet high in the center, that's plenty. A moose is going to walk under a 20-foot high thing like that, no big deal. But they kept trying to squeeze it down more and more and more. Well, what if we made it 8 feet on the ends, and then it would only be 18 feet in the middle? Or what if we made it 7 feet on the ends? And, you know, at some point we just had to say, I wouldn't go there. And then finally we kind of compromised, and I think that's working fine. I think moose are definitely using that. We don't have any collared moose in that area, unfortunately, so we don't really know if it's a free and easy passage. But I think of all the places in town where a moose will cross under something, that's probably the best example. The first few months, there weren't many moose, but moose are not as dumb as they look. And they're actually quite smart animals, and they can figure out things. If it's not going to hurt them, eventually they'll figure out how to use it. So they figured it out. One of the funny things about that, and again, planning, was DOT really wanted to put a fence along both sides of that road. You know, if you've driven Elmore, you know they've got a fence there. They were desperate to put a fence there to keep moose from crossing the road, except in the bridge, you know, underpass area. And that was a good idea. I mean, I am not a big fan of fences in most cases, but sometimes you got to have a fence. For example, the airport, you know, Anchorage International Airport has to have a fence around it, because you just don't want moose willy-nilly crossing in front of 747s and stuff like that. But some places need fences, and I don't normally like them. But right along there on Elmore, that was a good place for a fence. But what we tried to tell them was that, you know, moose will go around a fence. I mean, the fence only stops them from one direction. All they got to do is walk, you know, 50 feet, quarter mile, whatever, to get to the end of the fence, and they can walk right around it. And sometimes they'll still run across the road there, which that's kind of a hazard, but of course you can't make the fence infinitely long. But the worst thing that happens is they actually get inside the fence and then they ping pong back and forth. And especially a fairly narrow road like Elmore, I mean, it'd be bad enough on the Glen, but on Elmore, they would definitely do that. So we said, you know, look at the Glen Highway, where you've got those one-way gates for moose, because what happens is the moose, if the moose gets on the roadside of the fence, so it's in between these two fences, what they like to do is walk along the fence. I mean, they're trying to figure out how to get out. Typically, they're avoiding the cars as much as possible, trying to figure out how to get out. And they'll come to these one-way gates, and they're kind of funneled in, and they can just sort of push their way right through, and they walk right through. But if they try to turn around and come back, or if another moose comes to the fence and tries to push through the gate the other way to get onto the roadside, it doesn't work. The gates don't work that way. So we told DOT to, you know, look at those and do likewise. They didn't tell us, but they ended up with, they had much narrower right-of-way on the Elmore than they had on the Glen. So they thought, well, we really can't build these funnel things, so let's just put the gates in, the one-way gates, and they, of course, they're flush with the fence. So when they had them pretty much halfway finished, and Jesse and I were out there one day chasing porcupines or doing whatever, you know, inane things we do sometimes, and we saw the gates, and we were like, well, that's not going to work. So we called DOT and we worked with them again, and they finally, the light bulb came on. It's like, if you have a one-way gate that's flush with the fence and there's no funnel, the moose isn't going to, this moose is like, you know, running down the fence line because it's all freaked out and trying to figure out how to get out. It's not going to go, oops, there's a gate. I need to go out there. You know, there's not like a warning thing that says exit or something. The moose is going to run right past it. So you haven't really saved yourself anything. You've just created more of a problem. Plus, these bars, you know, that these kind of curly bars that the moose can kind of walk up to and look at and think, okay, I can push through that. And they do. They were about, the end should almost touch, you know, so the moose can't get through from the other side. But what they did was they were about a foot or 18 inches apart. So any calf worth his salt, moose calf, could easily walk back and forth through that gate, no matter which way it wanted to go. And that's what they do. The little buggers will find any gap in the fence that they can get through and squirt through it. And then what happens is the mom's on one side of the fence, the cow, the calf's on the other side of the fence, and now you've got a situation because the calf doesn't necessarily know how to get back through the same hole it got into. And now they're running back and forth, and one's on one side, one's on the other, and the mom's ready to kill somebody because she can't get her calf, and the calf's, you know, making these bleeding noises and trying to figure out how to get back to mom. So, you know, we work with them, and they actually ended up leaving all those in place, I believe, but they did put the funnels in basically at the ends of the bridge. So now what happens is the moose will get inside that thing, and I actually did see this happen one time. Within a week after they opened that road, this happened. Cow and a calf got on opposite sides because they walked from the end. So they're walking down the side of the road. The cow walks on one side of the end of the fence, and the calf walks on the other side, and you could see just from the tracks, it was just tracks, you could see from the tracks within 20 feet, they're running in circles and getting all agitated, and they both ended up running down to the next funnel, which was at the gate, and zipping out. So it did work. But I don't know, that's just kind of a for example of planning in action. Well, I'm speaking about fences, actually, another aspect of planning is a lot of times people don't necessarily call us, we call them. So a good example, I guess, would be the Fort Rich fence that Fort Rich had decided to build. This is right after 9/11. They got lots of money, millions of dollars, to build a fence, not quite around the entire base, because that would have been way into the millions of dollars, but they wanted to build a fence basically from the vicinity of Stuckagan Heights up on the hillside, pretty much north-south all the way across the Glen Highway, all the way pretty much to Beach Lake Park. It was a 30-mile fence, and it was going to be 8 foot tall with, I think it was going to have barbed wire on top, and then it was going to, and most of it was going to have a solid metal steel posts, rails along it too. And the whole idea was, after 9/11, they're worried about, you know, force security and protecting the people and the equipment on base from terrorists, I guess. I mean, that 9/11 terrorists. So they came up with this fence idea. And it was like, my first thing when I saw this, I said, we're trying to protect the trees from the terrorists, because pretty much 99% of Fort Richardson is trees. And I was exaggerating, of course, but it seemed like a little bit of overkill. So we worked with the fort. One important aspect of that was the neighborhood of Muldoon. The whole Muldoon strip got all agitated about that too, because basically this fence with the wire and barbed wire and everything else was going to be right along people's fences. And yes, it was the military's property, and yes, they have every right to build a fence and, you know, keep people out. But it was going to be ugly. It was, if you lived there, it was going to look like all of a sudden a maximum security prison was, you know, up against your wall, up against your property there. So between Fish and Game and others and the community members, we worked with the Army, and they made some compromises, which I think they were happy with, and we were very happy with. And the main one was that, again, keeping wildlife in mind, we said, you know, a 30-mile fence, wildlife aren't going to be able to easily get from one side of Anchorage to the other, and they need to, because if they think they're going to walk across Anchorage because the snow's too deep on one side and they want to get to the other side, and they've done it for the last 10 years of their life, and all of a sudden they've got a 33-mile fence to contend with, they're just going to sit there until they starve to death because they can't get to where they want to go. So not every moose, obviously, but some probably would. Or they'll try to find the gaps in the fence, because every fence has gaps in it. You got to have a gate. You know, there's got to be some way for people or vehicles to get in. And a lot of times on these fences, the gate's open for part of the time. And even when it's not, like at Coolis Air Force Base, the National Guard folks, I mean, they can have their gate closed 90% of the time, 95% of the time. But when they open it to let a vehicle through, every once in a while, a moose scoots through. I mean, they can't seem to stop it. What do you do? Jump in front of the moose? Because they'll just run you over. So every fence set pretty much has a gate in it. So you always have to worry about those gates letting moose into places where you don't want them to be. But we worked with them to basically have gaps in the fence, which is kind of a hard concept. It's like they want the fence for security, but they were willing to put gaps in it. And the gaps were primarily for moose, because moose weren't going to be able to get through that fence. So they put every quarter mile or so along that fence line, they've got about a 2.5 or 3 foot gap. And they put big metal posts in front of these gaps to keep someone from driving a four wheeler or something like that through, because they're worried about an army of, you know, people on terrorists on four wheelers getting into the woods on the east side of the highway. No, I'm kidding. I'm giving them a hard time. They have very legitimate concerns, but sometimes it's like, I don't know. But anyway, it's worked really well, I think. The wildlife get through the fences. And of course, the foxes and the squirrels and the rabbits could pretty much get under the fence. You know, the fence didn't always quite touch the ground, and animals like that can figure out how to get under fences. But moose especially, and to some extent, bears and other bigger animals have a harder time. You know, bears can climb fences, but I didn't want to even envision what was going to happen if bears tried to climb this 33-mile-long fence and got tangled up in the barbed wire, because who are they going to call? Me, to go get the moose out of the, go with the bear out of the barbed wire. And so I don't even think they have barbed wire along most of it either. I think they got rid of that idea. So it turned out to be a not so bad fence, and for their needs, and it turned out to be okay for wildlife, I guess, in the end. And I think even the people in Muldoon were more or less happy. I don't know, someone from Muldoon here could contradict me, but it was better than the alternative. And the Army did very well in working with the community and everyone else to do that, because they had some concerns and we had some concerns, and we just got together on that. That's how planning works best. Probably the best example I had for long-term planning, which was really successful, because most of the times when you do planning, you can't really put your finger on the thing and say, okay, that time when I did that little planning job over there, that was very successful. Maybe some people can do that, but I have a hard time, because mostly it's kind of nebulous. Did you do good or did you not do good? At least it's not worse than it was. I guess that's good. But with the case with Canada geese in town, this was about 10 or 15 years ago. A little bit of background, I think it was, I've heard several rumors, but the ones that seem to make the most sense are that there really weren't any Canada geese nesting in Anchorage proper, you know, like 40 years ago. They would nest, a few of them would nest kind of around the periphery, like in, you know, Potter Marsh, places like that. But my understanding was that there were very few Canada geese in Anchorage until a bush pilot brought a few of them over from the west side of Kinnick Arm and dropped them off into Lake Hood, is what I've heard. So just, it was kind of a cool thing. I mean, Canada geese, they're a symbol of the wild. You know, you love to hear them coming back in the spring and honking, and they're really cool animals. And he probably thought he was doing, this is a true story, he probably thought he was doing a great thing. He said, I'm bringing some geese over here, and people can watch them, and they're going to be fun to have kind of floating around in the lake. Canada geese can breed like rabbits when they put their mind to it. And these geese started pumping out babies, and pretty soon we had a Canada goose population, breeding population in the Anchorage Bowl, you know. And then at the same time, Anchorage got a whole bunch of money. I think it was sort of pipeline, post-pipeline times when the taxes, money was rolling in to the coffers, and people were putting in parks, and you know, ConocoPhillips and folks were building big buildings with nice grassy lawns, and BP and any place, all these big, huge, expansive lawns, and all these sporting the soccer fields and places like that. The city put in a whole bunch of these back in the 70s and 80s, and guess what? Canada geese like to eat. They like to eat grass. They're not eating. They don't eat just necessarily. They don't have to eat wild stuff. They love manicured, fertilized Kentucky bluegrass or whatever we plant in our fields. And so the geese that were nesting in sort of the boggy areas around town were then bringing their babies to, and we also created a bunch of lakes in town, lakes and ponds. We, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, we were damming up, Campbell Creek, the lower end of Campbell Creek, and creating, you know, lakes there and lakes all around town. And so now you had the perfect habitat for Canada geese. You had boggy places to nest and hatch their babies, and places to move to when they molted their feathers and couldn't fly, these lakes. And then when they started flying in the late summer, huge, expansive, fertilized fields where they could get as much nutrition as possible, put on some weight, and then fly south for the winter. And so the population of Canada geese, all of a sudden, starting in the early 80s, it was increasing at a rate of like 13 or 15% per year, which, you know, if you've got money in the stock market, that's pretty darn good. I mean, we've done better, but in the last few years we haven't. So if you got, you know, that's a good rate. And the numbers were going from a few thousand to many thousand. And unfortunately, we didn't figure out what was going on until it was too late. And that's 1995, I think, was the AWACS crash, the big Air Force jet that ran into a flock of Canada geese, I think 24 geese that were flying off of Elmendorf Airfield or flying by, and just during takeoff, which is the most critical time for a plane, sucked them into the engines or something and lost power and crashed, and all 24 folks were killed. It wasn't 24 geese. It was probably more geese. 24 folks were killed. So that was a horrible tragedy. And I can't say anybody was at fault. I mean, it was kind of a growing situation. The airfields weren't doing quite as good a job of keeping geese off because it was kind of a new thing. It was like all of a sudden, within a few years, the goose numbers were going up thousands and thousands, and all of a sudden, there's plenty of geese around, plenty of geese. But now it's like crisis mode, and what are we going to do? We got to have a plan. So Fish and Game and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the military reservations other folks, other agencies got together to come up with a plan. What are you going to do about the geese? And one of the first things we did was we did a survey because we wanted to find out what the people of Anchorage thought about this. Now, obviously, you can't have geese flying in front of planes. That's, no one wants to fly if you have a high chance of crashing. And it was getting to be pretty bad. If we let things go, you know, within a few years, we'd have 20 or 30 or 40,000 geese flying around town. So we needed to act. But it turns out that most people in Anchorage wanted to have about half the number of geese that we had. We actually asked them, do you want, you know, way more, you know, about half as many, about twice as many, or way less, or whatever. We asked them a variety of questions, and the survey came back about half as many, which was what the population of geese was about 10 years before. When they were very, and we were also getting all these complaints from homeowners over they were increasing at a astronomical rate. The geese were, you know, eating. They were basically loitering on their lawns all day long. If they lived near a lake, the geese would just, a flock of geese, you know, 40, 50, 80 geese would just move onto your lawn. And I believe a Canada goose defecates about 7 times an hour. I mean, it's an incredibly high rate because they're processing this grass through really fast. And so you, within a few days, you know, 40 geese, you can pretty much slime a yard or a athletic field or something like that. So people were definitely complaining about the geese eating their lawns and pooping all over everything and whatnot. So we're getting both those calls and the danger calls. So the plan was, with all these agencies, was to reduce the number of geese to at least half or about half what it was at the time. And remember, if we didn't do anything one year, it was going to jump up 16% the next. So we had to stop them in their tracks as much as possible and then try to reduce them. So the first thing we did, and the airports thought this was a great idea, they wanted to do it, was we said, you know, in the past, we've always said, before you have to kill a goose, you should chase it off. You know, give the goose a chance, chase it off the runway. Well, when you have so many geese, what you figure out is the geese are flying in a big circle and then landing back behind you someplace. And if you've got geese in the airport, the best thing to do is keep them on the ground, not chase them up in the air. So we said, you know, shoot them. If they're on the airport, just shoot them. And they'll quickly learn that those airports are bad news. So the airports had lots of grass around them, and they were great places for geese to feed. But they started shooting way more geese. And the geese, within a year or two, figured it out. You don't want to go to that airport. And there, we have a lot of airports in town. We have the military ones, Elmendorf, this is a big one, and Anchorage International, of course, but also Merrill Field and a bunch of smaller ones in town. And so they actually hired the USDA's Wildlife Services folks who do a really good job of things like this. So they were out there pretty much patrolling the areas and running up, and they were hazing the geese when they could, but they were also shooting way more than they used to, and the geese figured it out. That was one of the three things we did, which was probably the most effective at the airports, and it was very critical, I think. The other thing was we wanted to stop them in their tracks. We didn't want there to be any more geese. We were trying to get them lower. So one way to sort of stop them is to stop letting them lay eggs. And what other cities had done, like Seattle and places like that, was in the years past, so we had some lessons to learn from these folks. What other cities had done, like Seattle, I believe, in order to stop the egg production, was they sprayed like a mineral oil or a salad oil or something on the eggs, which coats them and basically suffocates the young, depending on how big it is. You know, you basically stop the egg from hatching. And the goose will sit on the egg for another few weeks or a month longer than usual, thinking, you know, it's been a long time. It's been 3-4 weeks and they should hatch. And now it's another 2-3 weeks and by gosh, it should hatch. And eventually they'll get up and leave it alone. But we thought a much more humane thing for the geese and a much more enriching thing for the people would be to actually collect those eggs to be eaten. South Central Foundation, a native corporation, I believe, branch here in town, private nonprofit, or maybe they are for profit. They had a bunch of folks on their list, a bunch of native elders from around the state, living here in Anchorage, of course, that thought that was the greatest thing in the world. So we got these collecting parties together and a bunch of the big boggy areas around town, and we went out and collected eggs. And one year, I think we collected 600 eggs, goose eggs. They were putting out eggs like crazy, and we weren't even finding, you know, half of them. But we ended up collecting a bunch of eggs and donating them to these folks, and they thought that was the greatest. And at the same time, we started collecting actually gull eggs, seagull eggs, and many folks would eat those too because they lived in coastal areas where they historically, traditionally ate gull eggs and thought those were really good. And this all worked really well until we had the bird flu scare a couple of years ago, and that shut the door. Luckily, the program was done by then. We had achieved success, and I'll tell you, it wasn't all our fault, but can't claim complete success for ourselves. But so that was the second thing, was to basically collect as many eggs as we could find in a reasonable amount of time and get them to folks that would eat them. And the third thing was, you know, obviously we're going to miss a bunch of eggs because you can't get to every boggy area. You don't have enough people, and the geese are nesting in all over the town. So the other thing was, they would hatch their babies, and once the babies were a few days old or a few weeks old, they would take them to the nearest pond, not necessarily the nearest pond, but a close one, pond or lake or whatever. And you'd have these gang broods, they're called, or just one particularly good mom or auntie goose would end up with 20, 30, 40 young, you know, behind her, and she would take care of them. And you'd end up with these big groups of young geese in some of the lakes. So we would gather them up, and we'd band all the adults just to, you know, keep better track of the population. But we'd take these basically teenage geese when they were almost ready to fly and fly them across to Susitna Flats, across the inlet, and let them go there. Because what scientists had found in the lower 48 especially over for many, many years, was that where the goose learns how to fly is where it will come back to. It doesn't know it was born in Anchorage. Where it learned how to fly is where it's going to come back to. Unless, of course, it mates with another goose and ends up going back where, you know, he or she goes to. But so we were taking, I don't know, 50, 60, 80 or more geese, maybe 100 some years, over to the other side of the inlet, letting them go. And, of course, some of those were shot by hunters. You know, the hunting season came, and some of them were shot, but a lot of them survived. And sometimes one of them would kind of come through Anchorage. Some of them actually came back to Anchorage and stuck here. I don't know if it's because, again, they made it with another goose when they were 4 years old and ended up coming here. But for the most part, we didn't see those collared geese that we moved across the inlet back again. So those three things over the course of, I think we did that for about 5 or 6 years stop the overproduction in our eyes, the overproduction of geese. But we don't think that reduced the population necessarily. What I think reduced the population of geese finally to the desired number. We're actually a little bit below what the number that we thought we were at, 4,000. We wanted to get down to 2,000, and I think we're below that now, maybe even 1,000. And what happened was the predators figured out what was going on, and all of a sudden we have, in the last 15 years, we have way more foxes, red foxes, than we used to have. The eagles probably were killing Canada geese, 20 years ago, but now there are at least a few eagles that have figured out how to nail them in the air and nail them on the ground, and they really work over the geese when in some of their in the coastal refuge in Potter Marsh and places like that. So between the eagles and the red foxes and the coyotes, we probably have more coyotes now than we had 20 years ago. The predators have done a very good job of keeping the goose population down, so the agencies can't claim complete credit for this. I think the predators came through in the end and were able to sort of put the stop to the overproduction in our eyes again of Canada geese in town. So that was one of the successful programs that we did planning.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA with Anchorage wildlife biologist Rick Sinnott. He was recorded at the Alaska Zoo speaking on planning to keep big wildlife in Anchorage as part of the Wildlife Wednesdays lecture series. Following his talk, he responded to questions from audience members.
The city was having a hard time with the idea of planning in their land use section for maintaining habitats. And maintaining bear habitats is a fairly easy sell. Moose, they seem to prefer to pretend never caused any problems. But I remember that you said it would be a good idea if little patches of suitable habitat could be conserved around town so that the creatures wouldn't find large areas after development filled in where they had nowhere to retreat. Do you have any suggestions how that could be done in practice? Because we can't be suppressing opportunities to develop land around here.
Well, yeah, like I say, Anchorage is people habitat, so I think that's probably the primary thing, but many people want to have wildlife here, and so that's where I come in, and that's my angle. But the city, because of very far-sighted people 20, 30, 40 years ago who established, agitated and helped establish Chukach State Park, Bicentennial Park, Kincaid, all these Beach Lake, all these big, huge city parks and state parks we have in the Anchorage area, and the green belts and stuff along many of the creeks, Anchorage is very well situated, I think, up until the present, certainly, for wildlife and people. And it's they've done a really good job. Could they do better? I'm a wildlife biologist. I would say yes. But wildlife biologists don't rule the world, probably, fortunately. And I think they've done a very good, very good job. There are places where they could maybe do a little better, and they're working to try to have more connectivity and stuff like that. You really don't want brown bears, like I say, running around downtown Anchorage. But it's good to have them on the outskirts. And it's good, I think, because I'm a wildlife biologist, to occasionally have one squirt into the city and to, rummage around a little bit and give everyone a big thrill and realize that we are maybe the dominant species, but not necessarily the top of the food chain all the time. I don't mean that I'm not making light of the fact that people get hurt. I'm just saying that humans need to be a little humble too. I mean, that's a good thing. So I think the city has done a very good job because of folks that have agitated and sort of helped lead the city in these directions. And one of the things I was going to mention tonight was one of the most important aspects of planning is you, because no one's going to listen to a wildlife biologist, blather on and on about wildlife. They want to hear from the public. Politicians want to hear from the public. Bureaucrats want to hear from the public. Engineers, planners, everybody does. So, if you feel strongly about something, you need to, make your voice heard. And the public always has more weight. The public as an entity always has more weight than any one person, be they wildlife biologist or, governor maybe. I mean, the public has a lot to say. And if people agitate and people, make sure that the government understands what they want, then that's very, very powerful. Who else had a question?
I know you guys just did a survey on bears, and you kind of did this goose example. I thought that was really good. Have people decided how many bears they want in Anchorage? Is it the same number, some lesser number, or some greater number?
Thanks, Doug. I'm glad I pass you all those questions beforehand because you're reading right down the list. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, and in fact, I never talked about the survey, and I'm incredibly sorry about that because that was one of the most exciting things I wanted to talk about. These things really inform us. It's on our Fish and Game website. So, you know, if you Google Fishing, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, you'll find our webpage, and you'll work your way. If you get into the wildlife conservation thing, you'll find the survey. It's under planning, I think, or, you know, guess what, planning. Those evil words. But you'll find it. Or maybe you can probably even Google the title, you know, Anchorage Residents Opinions on Bear and Moose Population Levels, just any part of that. If you know how to work Google, you can find it. Anyway, that's a great survey. And what that told us, it was a very different survey from the one we did 13, 14 years ago in that this was a mail survey. And it was, you know, random telephones around the Anchorage area, over 1,200 folks. So it's a big, big survey. The previous one was a mail survey, and it had, I think about 800 or 900 folks that participated. And both of them have told us that people in Anchorage, not everybody, obviously, because we're a very diverse and mixed and opinionated bunch of people, but it says that most people, in fact, 2/3 to 3/4, kind of in general, if you look at the different kind of questions, want to have bears around in Anchorage. Now, not all those people want to have them in their backyards. But a high percentage of people wanted to have bears in Anchorage someplace, if not in their neighborhood, then at least someplace. And, of course, if you can throw Chugach State Park into that, most people, I think, want to have bears in Chugach State Park because it's a state park. And if you have them in Chugach State Park, then you're going to have them in the very backyard of probably 1,000 people that live right along the edge of Chugach State Park. So I think most people are very realistic in that they know that bears, at least from our survey, they know that bears are, you know, dangerous and a potential threat and a risk. But the surprising thing about the survey was that we actually asked so many folks these questions that we were able to partition some of the user groups and some of the places where they live. So we divided Anchorage into basically three zones, and one of them was more or less midtown, downtown, and West Anchorage, kind of from Lake Otis over to the west. So that's sort of the downtown West Anchorage. One of them was East Anchorage, so pretty much from Lake Otis, including Muldoon, all hillside, all that area. And then the third area was every place else, so Eagle River, Chugach, Girdwood, you know, all those places. And we found that based on, just in general, based on the areas people lived in, the people in the outlying areas, Eagle River, Girdwood, and the people in East Anchorage, Muldoon Hillside, were more tolerant of having both black and brown bears around than people in West Anchorage. Go figure. I mean, people in West Anchorage hardly ever see a bear. I mean, it's familiarity. I mean, they've seen them around. Their neighbors have seen them. They know they're there, and they're just a little more tolerant of it, maybe because of that. And then maybe even more surprising, or maybe not, we divided it between, we asked people about their park use and about their trail use. And it was very simple. We said, you know, would you say that you use trails, you know, rarely, often, frequently. You know, we gave them several categories, and we let them pick which ones they said. So people sometimes exaggerate one way or the other, but I think people are more or less honest about that. And then we took those, and we took the people that said that they use both trails and parks not at all or rarely, and versus the people that use them, you know, sometimes or frequently, and compared those two groups, the people that used them more and the people that used them less. And both the trail users and the park users were much more tolerant of brown bears and black bears and moose. Even in places like we some of the questions mentioned Bicentennial Park. And this was, remember, just a little over a year after the two ladies got mauled by a brown bear in Bicentennial Park. And we thought, oh boy, we're taking a real risk here. It's like the lawyer that, you know, you don't want to ask the questions that you don't know the answer to. But we felt pretty strongly that we wanted to ask people the real questions, and we did. Do you want brown bears in Bicentennial Park? And by gosh, most of the population said yes. And the higher number of trail users said yes, the non-trail users, people that said they were non-trail users, not park users. So, again, just like the last survey that was 13 years ago, I feel very strongly that this is a cross-section. It's a random sample of Anchorage residents, so therefore it projects what the Anchorage population wants. And obviously not everyone wants it. And almost all these categories, brown bears in Bicentennial Park or whatever, there was a strong, very strong minority, you could call them, I guess, but, you know, 20%, maybe 30% that said, no, I don't want brown bears in Bicentennial Park. But most people did. So, yeah, I think that survey was very, very, it gave us a lot of good information along those lines. And I encourage you to take a look at it. The last survey, because it was a mail survey, we got to be, it was huge. It was people, must have spent a half an hour or more filling this thing out, and we had very good response rates, so we knew it was entertaining and useful to them or interesting. But we actually asked them a whole set of scenarios, about 15 or 20 different scenarios, where we'd say, it would be two or three lines. We'd say, a moose has been in your neighborhood for 2 weeks. It's killed a dog. What do you think the agencies or fish and game should do about it? We gave them a whole list of things. Do nothing, put up a sign, warn people, all the way down to kill the moose, right? Close the trail, for example, in a trail question. And, of course, at these lower levels, what I consider lower levels of harassment or concern, almost everyone, 90%, 80% of the people said, warn people, you know, don't do anything, stuff like that. But once you start getting into, you know, human risk and human dangers, of course, the proportions started to shift. But the only time we were able to provoke people into saying knee-jerk reaction, kill the bear, most people, was in the situation where a brown bear had mauled someone and was about to maul someone again. The first time it mauled someone, free pass. Really, I mean, most people in town were like, don't kill the bear, you know, put a sign up, you know, monitor the situation, all these other things we gave them. But most people didn't want us to kill the bear. But heaven help us if a bear mauled someone and it was going to do it again, because now we were in big trouble. Fishing game was in big trouble because we should have killed that bear. So anyway, people can be kind of predictable in one sense, but they can be very unpredictable in others. And we really pushed the folks that took the last survey. We didn't ask those questions this time because it was a phone survey and we would lose them in all the questions. But this was, so it was a very different survey. But if you look at the context of the questions and the responses and the experiences that people report, for example, we asked them how many times you've had to brake to avoid hitting a moose. You know, how many times have you been driving or been a passenger in a car where you've had to swerve or brake to avoid a moose? And 13, 14 years ago, it was, I don't know, 85 or 90% of the Anchorage population. This was not like last year. This was like historical, right? So who knows how many times they had to do it in 1 year. But most people have had to brake or swerve to avoid a moose. And this time it was pretty much the same thing. And same with hitting a moose. We actually asked them, how many times have you been in a vehicle that has collided with a moose? And it was about 10%. Yeah, almost everyone, me, you know, almost everyone.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Anchorage wildlife biologist Rick Sinnott. His talk on planning to keep big wildlife in Anchorage was recorded at the Alaska Zoo as part of the Wildlife Wednesdays lecture series on Wednesday, March 10th, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.